Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairways. We're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Stay tuned for a live broadcast on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Stay tuned for a live broadcast on HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
look around at all my friends, and I think of what I said to them, and I guess for once I can't pretend, so I hold my breath. What a perfect chance to start again. And the TV says it's all needed, and I guess for once
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, DJ Never Forget. Terry Dybalk is out today in San Francisco. He is scouting for a new cooking channel pilot. And I am not sure if I'm allowed to say anything more than that or if even say where he is, but he will be back next week. In the studio today, two amazing groups or businesses or labels or groupings of ideals and people eating pizza. That was, what was that?
Let me grab this pizza here.
Yeah. Some live pizza jockeying. We have DFA Records and Tasting Table. John and Justin and Chris, the intern, are here. And
Word.
We have Chris. Scott who from Tasting Table, who will be talking in a second. But Justin, what song was that?
That was Hold My Breath by Holy Ghost. That was a Tiger Woods remix. They were just in town playing the, as we talked about.
Yeah. Tiger and Woods.
Yeah. Did I say?
You said Tiger Woods.
Oh. At a late night.
I wonder if there's like a legal, like how close they can get to that.
I don't think legal crosses the minds of Tiger and Woods based on their music.
Yeah. Okay.
The legal department of Tiger and Woods is shut down.
So we will be hearing a couple live sets later in the show and talking to the DFA team about current records and situations and I don't know.
Occupy Wall Street.
But first, first up on the show, we have Scott from Tasting Table, who I think, from what your publicist says, I'm about to make the official announcement that you're the new editor-in-chief of Tasting Table Global Domination. Something like that. Welcome
indeed
to Snacky Tunes.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why don't you give our listeners a little background on what is Tasting Table and your ascension to the throne?
Okie dokie. Tastingtable.com is, the short answer is, it's a daily email food and drink magazine. It comes out as one story a day, 5 days a week. We have editions in New York, of course. The first one that we started was in New York. And we have San Francisco, LA, Chicago, DC. We have a national edition, a chef's recipes edition, and a cocktail edition, because that's critical.
It is critical. So as editor-in-chief, what do you oversee all of them, some of them? How does it work for you?
I oversee all of them. So we have editors in the respective editions actually on the ground, because that's one way that we separate ourselves, is we only write about things that we've tried. So when you're writing about food and drink, I think that's critical to know that it's good in a sense of context and to actually experience it. So we, the editors are in San Francisco itself, Chicago itself, DC itself, LA itself, and then in New York there's a couple of us here. So I kind of oversee everything, shape stories, overall editorial vision, and then that's the main gist.
So you have to go in order for it to be in Tasting Table. I mean, how different is that from other publications?
It kind of depends. I think in the daily email forum, it's certainly an anomaly, because a lot of them are preoccupied or focused on announcing things as they open. And we want to announce something when it opens also, but then we go and make sure it's good before you write about it, and then you have a kind of perspective and you can zero in on what is really worth recommending.
So, I mean, at the bottom of it, for whoever gets the emails or doesn't, at the very bottom, it's like a just announced type
exactly.
thing. And so that'll be your, we haven't been to this, but just to give you a heads up.
Right.
And then how do you choose which things you go to?
It's hard because you have to find a balance of high-end, low-end, geographic diversity, different kinds of cuisine. And then you have to balance dining stories with stories about cocktails and beer and wine and cooking and shopping. And
what are some of the stories that you really like to see come out through the newsletter? How do you think you'll be shaping the newsletter moving forward?
I think the trick is, again, to have trustworthy recommendations. Food is food, so it's subjective because everybody eats. That's part of what's great about it. But then if you know a publication or a person is trying the food they're writing about, it's easy to kind of figure out if you trust them or not. You may not agree, but at least you can do the opposite. And so we're trustworthy in the sense of we actually are trying it, and you can say, oh, I trust their opinion, so I'm gonna, if they say it's good, I'm gonna go eat it. Or if you don't trust, that's fine, but you at least know you can do the flip side and not go if you think it's good. But that's, I think, handy. And you can kind of zero in on what's great about a restaurant or a new cocktail bar or what have you based on a point of view.
I know that you came here from San Francisco when you were talking about this before. What would you love to see come out from San Francisco to New York? What do you think could work here?
What from San Francisco? Oh, what I miss the most, I used to live around the corner from Mission Chinese Food, which I would argue, it's gotten a lot of press lately, but it's one of those places that's actually warranted. I would argue that it's kind of changing the face of what it means to eat Chinese food in this country, in the sense of taking dishes that are pretty familiar in the Chinese American lexicon and doing a little bit of chefy things to them, but not making it fancy. So it's super like down and dirty Chinese food, but just with really good, careful attention to how it's cooked. So anything like that where you can kind of take a familiar cuisine and reconsider it, but not strip it of its authenticity, even though that's a thorny word. But that I would love to live around the corner from that again, and sadly
so
I
don't. It elevates it from just, you know, taking it like the greasy MSG type thing and keeps it, but
it's still greasy though. That's the thing, is it has all those elements, but it's really good beef and really good vegetables and all those kinds of things, so it tastes exactly like you would get in a divey place, just as greasy in the best possible way, but it's just got a little bit more, I guess, care.
How would you say that it compares to something like Red Farm that just opened up?
In that sense, Red Farm seems to be very focused on the kind of locavore, even though that word's kind of seen its glory days come and go. The locavore way.
Yeah, music and food comes together in this show.
I missed the glory days of locavore.
It's actually a good point. What happens when like really legitimate things like eating local and green, like when it becomes trendy, it's like the ideas behind it are not trendy. So how...
It's hard because it matters a lot, obviously, eating local and seasonal. But at the same time, there's been a lot of restaurants that have been opened since the locavore wave happened that say that they're local or seasonally focused. And then they actually trace if that is in fact true, and it's come true that it's not. So that's the curse of a buzzword and a trend-driven concept. But it's always a fine line to figure out. Oh, this is a noteworthy shift in how we dine or think about food, and then what happens when it kind of gets bastardized, or that always happens with everything. I'm sure music, mainstreaming, like any, like what's, it's always a balance.
Do you think, I know like in Portland and a number of other cities, like having fresh ingredients is kind of just a given these days, and putting on the menu is redundant. Do you think that New York is moving in that direction where it's like it should be just a given, or does it still have to be explicit as like a way to draw people in?
I think it ends up being still that people name drop. Even in the Bay Area, where you arguably was one of the founding cities for that way of thinking about food and eating, people name drop farms like it's nobody's business. Menu descriptions are just ridiculous there still.
Can you give us an example?
There's one that actually is warranted, I think, because it's kind of set the barometer with Chez Panisse. They still name drop where the food comes from in terms of the ranchers. But they're also, their entire point of view was all about sourcing. So I think it's, for them, I kind of give them a pass because they started the whole thing when nobody was doing it, and they're still doing it. So it's kind of you get a pat on the back for longevity's sake. But newer restaurants that are not nearly as, have such a strong point of view that are name dropping, I just feel like it's to jump on the bandwagon, not because it's actually useful or important. But I think if San Francisco is still doing it, New York, of course, is doing it because it's comparatively new to New York. There's always been a few restaurants doing it here, but I think that it's less so than San Francisco. So I think if it gets people excited about where the food comes from, I say bring it on.
Gotcha. All right, well, we're going to play another track from the DFA label, and then we're going to come back. We're talk about China, imports, a go-go.
Yes.
And some chef homecomings. You're listening to Snacky Tunes, and take away Justin. All right, That was just Yacht, the whatever remix by Justin Strauss.
And Brian Met.
Yeah. Oh.
It's a duo.
Oh, it's a duo?
It's a duo.
Who's whatever one and who's whatever two? They figure that out.
That's whatever and he's the other whatever.
Yeah. Shout out to your other intern, by the way, Imogene.
Yeah, Imogene Strauss.
Is she holding down the fort? Is she over at PS1 today?
I believe she is at PS1 today, and tomorrow's her birthday. I wanted
Happy
to bring
birthday.
That up.
How old is she going to be?
She's going to be 20. Yeah.
14.
She'll be 22, and we're celebrating. I was going to drop this anyways. Over at Mr. H tomorrow night, I'm doing a party there called Have a Killer Time, and we have DJ Chaos playing. We're actually releasing a record from him in November called From Inside, and we also have Marcus Marr in town from London, and he did a remix for us for Shit Robot, which I think I'll play later in the show.
Awesome. So we have Scott, the brand new editor-in-chief from Tasting Table.
She just texted me.
That's how fast the internet is. Before we get into trends, I wanted to bring up the new test kitchen that you guys built, which is amazing. Shout out to Eric.
Yes.
Who I work with.
Yep, Eric Chung.
Eric Chung, who is now over at the Ace Atelier.
Yep.
Tell me about the idea behind the test kitchen and, you know, what the idea of it is.
Yeah. The idea was twofold. One, since we started doing recipe-focused edition called Chef's Recipes, that's a lot of the word recipe, we have been testing every recipe that comes our way to make sure it actually works for home cook. There's a lot of noise and dreck out there on the recipe tip in the internet. So with that in mind, we were kind of testing all over the place, kind of piecemeal wherever we could, and it was critical to find a kind of central location and build one so that we could do that. And commensurate with that, we wanted to have a space to actually eat for events, whether they be for us or for kind of our cohorts and friends. And so we had, as you know, your coworker Eric Chung, who now is at the Ace. He and Lauren Day from Love is Enough joined together and built this beautiful space at a loft in Soho that half of it is this state-of-the-art test kitchen designed for recipe testing and development, and then the other half is this entertaining space with a really long communal table broken into three parts and a bunch of kind of modular seating areas, kind of loungy. So it's been it opened in mid-June, and it's been quite the boon, and it seems to be a hit.
I have to say, shout out to whoever did the trade-outs there. Pretty much almost everything in there was gotten for free.
placement-y.
It's pretty amazing, the La Crusade.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't know, display of everything La Crusade you could ever want down to. The tiniest of pots is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and then we have the kind of old schooly Le Creuset stuff, and we got from Polyscience a few items. They're pals of ours. So you have the anti-griddle that Grant Ackett and Alinea kind of was.
Oh yeah, explain the anti-griddle to people.
So essentially, it's like a griddle. It's like a freezer unit, but with a griddle attached on the top. So instead of heating on a griddle, you freeze in a griddle. So any item you put on there, it freezes on a flat silver panel. So it's kind of like topsy-turvy with heat.
What do you make on there?
We have not made that much stuff, but when they demoed it, the founder of Polyscience and one of his cohorts came and showed us demo-wise how to use it. So we made these kind of cheesy, creamy, sweet lollipop things. So you would make like kind of a dairy base.
I can't even wrap my head around what that
is. Yeah,
looks
imagine
like
a frozen lollipop. So it's easy to make because you can put the stick on the anti-griddle in the batter, so it's flattened, and then it melts in your mouth as you chomp away.
Got it. So one of the things that we want to touch upon before we get there is that I know that you write about it, but do you do a lot of trend predictions on the thing or things to look out for?
It's interesting. We don't do kind of fall preview-y trend forecasting explicitly, but I think it ends up happening just because we have to keep track of what's afoot in the restaurant world. So we end up kind of touching on trends one way or the other, even though we don't do like the Times and Time Out New York and New York Magazine.
You don't have like Tasting Tables like 101.
No, none of those kinds of things. But I think if you look at the aggregate of what happens over a few months during the fall, you see some through lines and that kind of thing.
So I know we had talked about Red Farm before, but there's like one of the things that we had discussed before was like the incoming of China, essentially. Red Farm, Wong, the new Fatty Q, Young Silk.
Yeah.
So I want to get your thoughts on that and, like, you know, see, like, how the restaurants are moving towards that?
Or? Yeah, it seems, I'm new to town, so they moved here in January, but it seems to me, especially this fall, there's a mass of kind of Chinese-influenced and Southeast Asian-influenced places, some of which, like Red Farmer focused on, we'll go back to Locavore. Why not use the word one more time? Locavore-influenced and food, but turning it with Chinese technique and kind of ingredients. So there's that, and then there's a new place, Wong, Samson Wong of Cafe Asian's new place in the West Village has that kind of bent to it also. And then there's just kind of other places that have a Chinese focus. There's a new place, Cafe China, that is kind of like Shanghai in the 1930s is the model for it, and the menu's enormous, kind of iconic dishes from all over China, whether it be Sichuan or the North or the South. And then Fatty Q, of course, which combines barbecue and the kind of big, bold, funky flavors of Southeast Asia, just opened a new location in the West Village. And bless them for not doing a copycat. It's the menu is almost entirely different.
Really?
Yeah. There's like two dishes from the original one in Williamsburg that are on the menu.
Is it the fried fish bones?
It is not the fried fish bones. They may have that, but I don't think that that's one of them. It's the ribs.
Chris,
Chris is smiling.
Are you?
We have a fried fish bone fan.
Are you into fish?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Anything from the ocean.
You need to go to Fatty Q. They'll serve you a full fish, and they'll take the bones back and then fry the bones, and then you eat that.
Chris eats that, the dried squid in the bags you get in Chinatown.
Yeah. That's right.
Like, it's like big league chew to him. He just
no one can see this because it's radio, but his face is like totally lit up. Like, it's pretty amazing.
That's a new meaning to big league
chew. He heard fried fish, bones, and West Village, and he knew... It was imminent.
We're going there. Ding. Scott, we're going to run out of time here soon.
It happens.
But I want to ask you, just to go back to changing out words, foodie.
Yeah.
How do we get rid of that, and what replaces it?
I think the first part, there's probably ways to get rid of it. The second part is, I don't think the English language has a word that's going to suffice easily. There's no one right word. Gourmand is disgusting.
Gastronaut
is vomitory and incarnate. They're all kind of bad, and I guess it's tricky when we're a country that's new to caring about food in a kind of implicit way. So I think that's part of it. You can get away with it in Italy or France, where there's a long culture of regional foods and influences and whatnot, so it's not quite as snotty to
but
care about food.
Foodies over there. There's just like
exactly, but there's some other word that could right, but that's why it's interesting. Exactly, it's way of life, and for
food,
us, it's
food
like
hipsters,
foodist trend, fipsters.
I feel like foodie is like the same thing as food hipster.
It's pretty close.
Foodster.
Yeah.
That'll probably get torn apart just as much as
make it hippie and make everybody mad.
Yeah, that's true. And now that you're new here and you've only been here since January, where have you wanted to go eat? Because I know John here has been dying to come to Roberta's. So where have you wanted to come eat?
Same. I have not had a chance to come to Roberta's. We had some amazing pizza. So I think like them, I'm going to sneak off and have some other eats while I'm here since I'm already here. Other places that I want to go, where have I not been to? It's more like places that I want to get back to that I have to, because I have to go to so many new places for work. I went to WD50 again. I hadn't been in like 5 years since I came to visit, and it was amazing. Just to know that it's still open and he's still pushing the envelope, and it's as good.
Yeah,
as
he was at the LeFooding opening event with he and Andrew teamed up. James also cooked there as well, which was nice to see him. Weird all white chef's coat, wearing all white chef's coat and everything. But Wiley did root beer braised ribs with Andrew.
Oh, nice.
Which were fantastic.
I'm not surprised.
He's still serving foam.
He is not so foamish these days, but the lot when I was there not too long ago,
I'm not a fan of foam.
Not the foam.
I like the foam, but
you like the foam?
Everything in it has its place. But he has this new thing called foie falafel, so it's essentially a foie gras in falafel form.
I'm sorry, it's
freaking delicious.
Foie gras in falafel form.
Uh-huh.
Think
about it like
that sounds amazing.
Yeah. Think about how foie gras when it melts, it's almost like tahini on a falafel. Yeah. It's like, but it's meat tahini.
Is the foie gras in the shape of a waffle?
Falafel.
Falafel. Oh, falafel.
Falafel. So it's in the shape of a falafel ball. And it's in a little mini pita. Right. You know, it's got the whole shebang.
When I was there the first time, it was the first time I'd ever had foie gras, and it was an egg foie gras in the shape of an egg with like a cherry sauce in the middle, which kind of blew my mind. And then I found out what foie gras was.
And did that blow your mind too?
And I did not eat it for like a very long time afterwards. And then I got over it.
There you go.
Well, Scott, congratulations on everything.
So
thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Do you want to give people the nuts and bolts of how to sign up, yep. find you, follow you?
It's free to subscribe. It's tastingtable.com. You just log on, pick whatever edition you want to subscribe to. Easy peasy.
Okay. And thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Greg.
And now up on the show, we have a set from Justin Miller.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just about it. And then we'll be back after that to talk to John Galkin from DFA.
Bye-bye. Wait, time, waste of time. he gonna say bye bye? Wait, time, waste of time. Ain't nobody gonna say bye bye. Wait, time, waste of time. Ain't nobody gonna say bye bye. Thank you.
All right. Justin, do you want to tell us what you just played?
What was that? Oh, yeah, that was the Marcus Marr remix of Take 'Em Up by Shit Robot that I mentioned earlier. And then Graceful Exit.
Featuring Walter Jones?
Yeah. Entrance is a track.
So I wanted to ask, because it's never like in any of the write-ups, but how did you, Justin, get involved with the DFA crew?
I don't know. How did I, James?
You want me to tell the story?
Well, you, well, I'd love to. I'd love to hear. I'd like to hear your version.
I actually have no idea.
I get tired of telling my version.
But it's more interesting because I have no idea how you. It was a journey from California.
It was a journey from California. I was a huge fan when the label started, and I guess it was, you know, the first singles that got me started as a DJ, and I used to dream about working there one day. But being in California and then being in New York and, you know, super cool, I didn't really think that was possible. And then I found myself in New York and with, like, kind of like the sole mission of working there, but was willing to, you know, be a record store clerk again if necessary. I didn't really know anyone in New York. And I sent a pretty straightforward email to the random web address asking, you know, to let me have a shot at interning. I think I said, like, you know, I'll order you Chinese food, I'll clean the toilets, you know, very unprofessional. My friend who was applying for Yale graduate school at the time said, you know, I should maybe be a little more professional. And I was like, no, I'm gonna keep
John,
it real.
John, do you remember this email?
You kind of do. You were like, just get them in. Just, I think you told Jane.
Well, I think it was at a time when we had stopped hiring interns because I was very frustrated with how moronic most children were.
And I was old. So this was my first time interning ever. And I was like 27. So I had previous jobs.
This is a charity case, basically.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, totally. And I kind of had some skills. Like, you know, I wasn't.
We took him in. We bathed him.
Yeah.
We shaved.
Fed him disco.
Underneath all that. What's that?
Fed him disco.
Fed him disco, yes, records.
Definitely. Yeah. It's been an education.
For sure. So for the, you know, six people in Brooklyn who don't know what DFA Records is, John, do you want to, and actually a majority of our food listeners, since we have them, do you want to give a brief background on what it's all about?
DFA Records is a label started in 2001. By myself and James Murphy of LCD Sound System and Tim Goldsworthy, who's no longer with the label. And we started the label to put out The Rapture and the single House of Jealous Lovers, and didn't really have a plan from there. We just knew we had a good song and a band willing to let us put out a song that James and Tim had recorded. And it was just one of those weird zeitgeist moments where it just sort of propelled itself. And here we are. We are celebrating our 10th year anniversary.
Any plans for a party?
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot of parties going on, sort of smaller ones around the world, trying to group together as many different... Right now we have a lot of DFA acts on the road, DFA acts promoting new records. We just have so much music in the sort of in the marketplace. A lot of times we don't have live bands out there. Right now we have Holy Ghost and Yacht and Planning to Rock and Shit Robot and Brinthorn Dance School.
Like, they're all Benoit and Sergio
and there's a lot of people who are just performing live, which is exciting. So we've like just today we confirmed a show in like Barcelona with like five different DFA acts. But basically we're using this past September 1st date, and using from there for the next 12 months as our basically our birthday year.
That's pretty good birthday.
That's
year.
A pretty good birthday year. So hopefully by September 2012, I think we're going to have sort of a grand finale, and that gives us a nice window to
which would be the LCD
plan
reunion,
that
right?
No.
So there was real no original vision.
And The Rapture. I forgot to say The Rapture. They're on
who were amazing.
Who played Webster
Hall.
Chris,
we saw you.
Chris was sweating. His job is to pogo and to sweat.
Yeah, that's pretty... How does that feel?
And don't talk.
It's pretty good.
Said, don't talk.
Yeah, he said don't talk.
I'm just kidding.
So if there was no original vision and you just put the song out, like, did a vision eventually take shape or a direction, or is it just...
Yeah, I mean, there was always a vision. The vision was basically to get... indie kids to dance. That was kind of what we brainstormed. But once we sort of put it out there, what came back musically from people we knew, friends of friends, it was just a sort of familial, like this family tree that just kept sprouting new bands. And one, it was, we always said our best source of A&R is our own bands who go on the road and come back and say, this one band opened for us in Austin. You have to hear this. And
I mean, for me, before I heard any of the DFA stuff, I was just like a straight rock and roll kid, and then heard you guys, and then I went all the way to get into like house music, and then I'm now coming back. How have you found the trend of, you know, like the combination of punk and dance music, and then splintering off, and then, you know, retaining a lot of those, the people that you kind of, the rock kid you helped convert?
I just think fans. We just made room for everything to exist together.
Yes.
If that makes any sense. I mean,
cause yeah, that does.
With our bands that we sign, there's it's a variety of stuff.
I think that's, I mean, I always say, like, the first record we ever put out was Beaches and Canyons by Black Dice.
Right.
So I joke that I thought we were making the message clear that sort of anything goes, even though we were still pegged when the House of Jealous Lovers single came out as a sort of punk funk dance label, like, you know, but
that's like the fooding.
Yeah, can't, punk funk is that we can't shake that term.
Can you still not shake
now,
it?
Well, now you're just, I just shrugged my shoulders. Well, no, we can't really. Because now that the Rapture, they're back on DFA and they have this new record out, reading all the reviews, like it's just bound to come up, and you just, eventually you just sort of shrug your shoulders. And I think we've, what's the word I'm looking for? We've sort of, we've gotten past it. You right. know? We've
accepted
it. Yeah, we've accepted it, and acceptance, that's one of the steps, right? And then we've moved on, yeah.
Before we get Justin on the sets again, I want to ask, it always talks that you're about, you were in corporate events before you started.
Right.
But like never says vague. What type things.
It was.
And I'm just curious what they were.
It was the first job I had. I went to NYU, and I graduated in 1994, and my roommate's first cousin had started this company, and it was something I wasn't even familiar with, which were... he was a talent buyer, and he would do these corporate events for investment banks and pharmaceutical companies and software companies, and it was in the 90s, and everybody just had, you know...
Money.
Yeah, it's like, what's that word again? And...
Oh, $100,000 for a party? Yeah, no problem.
Well, no, I mean, like, way more. I mean, it was just like...
That's internet, how much things are changed. I think $100,000 for a party.
I mean, I say the last event, because I left there in like mid-2001, but in the 90s, I mean, we were doing stuff for software companies where we would hire Aerosmith and pay them $1 million to perform at, like, you know, I can't even say the... You know, it was always confidential, even though a lot of times... You still read articles, oh, well... Bob Dylan did a corporate event in, you know, Phoenix, Arizona for Merrill Lynch or something. And those were the kind of shows we were doing. But we were talent buyers. So our job was to secure the artists, strike the deals with the agencies, and then do all the coordination, staging, sounds, lights, be on site. It was an amazing job.
Was there a crossover time when DFA was starting up that you were there that you were able to bring in any of the bands?
No,
or DJs?
No. But what's funny is, like, you know, LCD's done, like, they did some, and then we went to James won a Webby Award this year for the LCD broadcast on Pitchfork for the Madison Square Garden show, and Justin was the in-house DJ, and it was at the Hammerstein Ballroom. And so I go, and my old company was producing the entire event. And my old boss, J.B. Miller, if you're listening, which I know you're not, you're probably still at your desk, manically working. But he was there, and it was just incredible. I mean, it was just all came full circle. It was actually very, very sweet.
That's amazing.
It was amazing.
Is that show going to come out on DVD?
The Webbies?
No, not the Webbies. Jesus Christ,
okay. Oh,
well, man, I have Webbies 2010, 2009.
You got that one?
I got those. I was just...
I got that in Chinatown. Delay.
No, the final LCD show.
The final LCD show? Yeah, I think so. I mean...
We're kind of in the dark about it, but I know James is working on some stuff.
They're mixing related. The sound, and he's doing a couple of different film projects, but that's kind of all we know. But, you know, based on... timing, I think by like 2018 it should be on Blu-ray.
Okay, so we're gonna get Justin to set up for another set. As he does that,
excuse me,
where did the logo come from?
The logo came from Man, I should know. I think it was a... Was it Vedino or Miller or Murphy?
I think it was a combination of Tim and James.
Just doodling crappy, like, yeah, superhero.
I swear I came across the original hand-drawn version, and I pulled it for Vedino for that DFA art show that was down
there. Oh, the one on that graph piece of graph paper?
Yeah. It was actually, like, pen-drawn, and I think that's where he took the scan from. And
that was it?
Built it from that.
It was just... it was literally... a doodle. And it's like that classic lightning bolt when you're a kid that you keep trying to draw. It's like trying to draw like a 5-point star or something. Right. It just always comes out wrong. And that's...
And now it's like...
Which kind of sums up our entire aesthetic, where it's just like, just trying, but it's just like, it's so right and something about it that's wrong.
All right. So we're going to hear another set from Justin Miller, and then we'll be back with more from John Galkin of DFA Records. You are listening to Snacky Tunes.
Melba.
Peach Melba.
That's appropriate.
Yeah.
Peach Melba.
It's a food.
It's a food.
When we first started this show, we were going to one of the ideas, like, we'll just get like a food song to open every show, and that ran out so quickly.
You could use that. That could be your theme. Peach Melba. That's Melba. Also known as Juan McClain, who's also delicious.
He is very delicious. He DJ'd yesterday at the Beats of Space thing. I saw him with that glorious beard.
A glorious beard. You don't want to get in that beard.
I admire it from afar. So we've had labels on here, much younger and upstart labels that we're like, you know, to give advice. No, but you are celebrating a 10 year anniversary.
That's true.
Where a lot of these are like, we're on our first 7-inch type thing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we always like to do in the show is, you know, ask people who've done it. You know, it's like, what would you tell, you know, band label starting out, or like, what's the one thing that you wish you had known starting, and, you know, would have probably helped a little bit.
I remember saying something like, I'm gonna start a label. He's like, why would you ever do that?
I did.
Yeah.
I don't know why anybody would start a record label. I mean, right now, well,
it's tough. But people, everyone doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, for the people that want.
I knew nothing when we started. Right. I mean, it wasn't like, well, I had these. I mean, I knew stuff about music, but I didn't know. I hadn't gone to school for it. I hadn't worked at. I interned at other record labels when I was at NYU, all major labels. So that helps, because I knew what I didn't want to do.
Right.
And I knew the sort of indie road we wanted to navigate. Then, of course, we made the cliche mistakes of signing up with the major label for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, let me ask you that, because I obviously hindsight is always 20/20. But, you know, it's like, wow, I can get my records everywhere.
Right.
But, you know, the deal has come and gone. Like, do you think, would you have done it that way? Would you do it all over again? Or, like, how would you have possibly done it
differently? No, because it actually worked the opposite way for most of the artists, except really for LCD Sound System. And Hercules and Love Affair went through that deal as well. And I think they both fared very well. But a lot of bands where our deal was with EMI, and bands like, they were basically just saying yes to everything we were doing. So they would let us put out, you know, Black Dice through EMI, which made absolute, to us, we were like, oh, they just totally get us, and they're going to get so behind this record with a, you know, the giant ass on the cover, right. broken ear record. And it kind of, instead of going everywhere, it kind of went, it went somewhere in the middle. Like, whereas the indie distribution system that we have in place now for a lot of our bands, it's stronger and I think more appropriate. Well, we work with a couple of different people, but like for the Rapture record, we're working with a company called MRI, and for a lot of other titles, we work with a company out of San Francisco called Revolver, who are like kind of one of the last bricks and mortar sort of indie distribution getting into the. But, you know, sadly, there's just fewer and fewer indie shops. So much of our time is spent on digital distribution and focusing on that.
I mean, there was a lot of publicity about you guys signing with EMI, and did you feel it lent, maybe not to you, to the outside world, like more of like a legitimacy, or like, hey, this is established? Or do you think overall it was just more of a negative experience?
No, I think it was a positive experience, and they definitely kept us afloat for a long time, maybe when we wouldn't have been. But it also ended up creating a bit of a like a false economy, because once they shut the door, you're sort of left without a life raft.
Right.
And that took a little while to get back up on our feet. But you know, in hindsight, I still don't think we would have done it differently. I think it was an important lesson to learn. And to be honest, we were kind of there at the end of the glory days of EMI, where they were spending a lot of money and letting us do crazy things, and, you know, making ridiculous promo items and giving us lots of tour support.
What?
I mean, they made stuff for us. Like, we had custom made Newmark LCD LCD Sound System turntables,
two different kinds, like a portable and like
a, with like DFA lightning bolts for. This is for Sound of Silver.
Not even just like the slip mats, like the actual
turntables. No, actual turntables.
It actually came with a slip mat on it, though.
Yeah, with said LCD Sound System. In the box. In the box was custom made, and it had the Sound of Silver cover on it.
Yeah.
Wow. And they made like 400 of these and gave them all away.
Yeah. You'll find mine on eBay in the next coming year.
So just a few more before Justin takes us out. just a couple of quick questions. What is the one thing people should know about DFA?
We're a huge operation.
And we're both talking into the same microphone right now.
Yeah, which is kind of...
By the way, just, you know, there was an option of, because Chris isn't saying anything, there's two other microphones they there chose.
Is. I think we just like to be close.
Yeah.
To one another.
Who does all the stamping in the White Sessions videos?
Look at these hands.
Look at these.
Who do you think?
Look at that manicure. That's me. I usually wax my hands.
For the people who don't know what the White Sessions...
White
Album Sessions are, would you care to explain?
They are a very sort of costly, high-budget way we have of launching and promoting, introducing new releases on DFA. The idea came to me from watching Justin record shop on YouTube, and I was just so fascinated with this idea of watching him, and I was like, what the hell are you doing? You're just watching a record spin on a video. And he's like, no, man, I'm checking out old disco records before I buy them on Discogs or whatever. And I thought, how many kids are doing this at home where they're just sitting basically with headphones on watching a YouTube clip, just checking out tracks? And I thought, that's so great. And then also, like, you know, once we did, and Chris here, you know, he helps me on all of them, and they're, you know, they have their own kind of hilariously shit aesthetic, like everything we do. And once we made the first one, it reminded me of that Bastards of Young video by The Replacements. I think that was the song where the camera is just on the stereo speaker, and you're just watching the speaker rattle.
Right.
Basically, I think there's like a beer can or an ashtray or something on top of the speaker, which just kind of starts to move. But the entire video is just the stereo speaker. And it was on 120 minutes like every week for a year.
I mean, I don't know. I think like the whole, just the pulling it out with the stamps and everything, like the whole process.
And that really is like a day at the office. Yeah, no, it's like, we got new white labels. Somebody stamp it.
Them? Yeah.
We have the stamps. Let's check it out. And then I was, you know, and then film it. And it, I mean... You know, How Deep Is Your Love by The Rapture being a great example of that move. You got to do it with the right song. We introduced the world to that song via that method, and honestly, we accumulated like over 100,000 views on Vimeo.
That was the first
from
one I saw
single.
And I was like, this is awesome. This is, I didn't know it was a series. Like, this is so...
And that was one take. Yeah. And I was, right before we did it, I just looked at Chris. I was like, we can't just do this the way we did it before. Shit, do we have a disco ball in the closet? And that was it. And then I think I hung it on a coat hanger, and you see my feet. And I was wearing new Pro Keds I had gotten. And the next day we got a call from Pro Keds.
Really?
It's absolutely true.
Like sponsorship?
Saying, well, let's talk.
Oh.
We got shoes.
That's amazing.
You got bands.
Let's close on a question, and it is a rapture. It takes time to be a man.
Yes.
What makes that song so special?
So many.
It's like I saw in the email. What's that you wrote today just sort of has that sort of old school kind of almost like a hip hop sample vibe to it. I don't know.
It's for me, it's a universal appeal. Yeah, it's a great pop song. It does have a universal appeal, and I don't know. I think it's a very uplifting, inspiring song, and for me though, it's about that something about that piano line. Really gets me.
Okay.
I don't know. I love it. It's a great closing song.
It is an amazing closing song. Well, thank you guys for being on here.
Thank you. Thanks, Roberto's.
I wish you would have told me that you were going to ask that question, because maybe I would have ended this
with
song.
That song.
We could ask another question if you want to pull it out. Because it is.
We don't have it, though.
I do.
Oh, you do?
That's how prepared he is.
Oh, shit.
And you can have these records.
Oh, I will gladly take them.
These are all records from the office.
He is unwrapping.
Unwrapping.
Listen to that live, unwrapping a brand new Rapture record. Vinyl.
This is the DFA way.
All vinyl here.
It takes a little bit more time, but it's totally worth it.
It takes time to be a DJ.
So, John, is there anything else that you would like to add? I mean, 10 years of interviews, 10 years of probably the same questions. Is there anything that you've always wished you could say about DFA that no one ever asks you?
Insert James Murphy joke here. I don't
insert
know.
Insert now, yeah. I mean, we gotta get one in.
What's that?
You gotta get
one
in.
James Murphy joke? I don't have any good ones ready. For anyone who was at Lafooding, did you say you went to the?
I went to
James?
The 5 a.m.
Not when James.
No, but with Justin Cherno. Oh, shout out to him, who is like
yes.
amazing. Who I like, I said, only knew as a wine guy and
right.
didn't put it together for so long that it was. Well, it's, I would put it this way: I never knew that rock guys would move into like being like epic wine buyers and never.
Yes. Well, now and James is a chef. And by the way, for anyone who was there, he did not wash his hands.
Fair.
I just want to say that.
Let's end on it. Thank you guys for being here.
You're very
Chris,
thank you.
Good luck on that internship.
Thanks.
Yeah, we'll be back next week with, I don't know who we'll be with, but we'll be back and my brother will be here. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.